You're listening to Gossip Int, the way to gossip intelligently. Gossip Int is a podcast that helps listeners learn critical thinking concepts by applying them to well-known pop culture events and real-world technology-focused examples. Here with us today are Karen Frost and Laura Luthi. And I'm Caitlin Hopkins. Although all three of our participants today work for Microsoft, the views expressed on this podcast belong to us alone, and we do not represent the views of Microsoft. So Karen, today's structured analytic technique is Team A, Team B. What exactly is that?
Team A, Team B is probably the easiest structured analytic technique for people unfamiliar with this toolbox of techniques to understand. That's because we naturally use Team A, Team B argumentation all the time. It's just what it sounds like, a technique that allows us to address a controversial topic by arguing for or against a particular position or hypothesis. The strength of this technique is that it allows us to lay out the best evidence for each side while also poking holes in any weaknesses in the evidence or argumentation of the other side.
Okay, but that sounds kind of like just a high school debate, am I right?
Yeah, that's a great example of a time when we use this kind of technique. The key here is that both hypotheses should be equally strong, or that the people arguing each side have equally strong convictions. Again, these don't have to be game-changing issues like, should the United States ban capital punishment? That's often how it's used, but in reality, it can be something as mundane as arguing with your child about their best bedtime. When there's a third party acting as an arbiter for the exercise, laying out the evidence for the two sides allows the third party to understand the various facets of the debate and reach their own conclusions. But there doesn't have to be a third party. You can run your own Team A, Team B exercise when trying to make a decision. In that instance, you're helping yourself think through a situation logically and by considering all of the evidence.
Okay, so I guess I just don't see what makes it so special if we do this all the time.
Well, remember what Bobby Jane said last episode about people missing the point of critical thinking because they're not actually exercising their critical thinking skills regularly? Team A, Team B takes something that we do ordinarily anyway, picking sides, and forces us to move it from the realm of feelings into the world of facts and data. We have to marshal our evidence to support our position, giving structure to what otherwise might be structureless. I think that's the real takeaway here. It's okay to pick sides, but if we're going to do that, we not only have to have evidence for it, but we also have to understand what the opposing evidence is and why some people support that other side. In other words, we have to see the full picture.
So today's pop culture topic is the Star Wars universe versus the Marvel comic universe, otherwise known as the MCU. Both are beloved by viewers, both are owned by Disney. We can't really do a which is more fun to watch, Team A, Team B, structured analytic technique, because that's too rooted in subjectivity. But we can look at it from a business perspective. Let's say I'm the CEO of Disney, Bob Chapek, and I'm looking at making another big tentpole movie. I could greenlight a Marvel movie, or I can greenlight a Star Wars movie. Which should I make? Karen, you're Team A. Tell me why I should make a Star Wars movie.
The 15 Star Wars movies have cumulatively made $15.3 billion. That's an average of about $1.02 billion per movie. The 43 Marvel movies, in comparison, have made $38 billion, meaning an average of only $883 million per movie. The Star Wars franchise has also spawned 23 TV shows, a game show, and four documentaries, whose additional value I can't even begin to calculate. Star Wars projects are reliably successful and often spawn popular social media memes, as things like the child from The Mandalorian show. When they go in to see a Star Wars movie, audiences know they're going to see a quality, iconic addition to the franchise. Speaking of that audience, by the way, Star Wars is uncommon in that it hits multiple demographics. It's not just young people watching it. Everyone from Gen Z to baby boomers enjoy the good versus evil storylines, and the viewer demographics support almost an even split between all viewer age groups. Not to mention, 25% of internet users report being Star Wars fans, showing just how popular the franchise is. Between movies, shows, theme parks, merchandising, and more, the Star Wars franchise is estimated to be worth $70 billion. Even if the Marvel Universe approximates that value, when you factor in how many more movies and TV shows it took Marvel to get there, on a per-movie basis, Star Wars is definitely a better deal. And then in terms of storytelling, There's fertile ground in the Star Wars universe for the creation of new movies. Not only can new characters be easily introduced, they can be placed before or after the main events of the original Star Wars movies, as happened for Rogue One. Or fan favorites like Princess Leia and Jar Jar Binks, just kidding, can be expanded upon, as for Han Solo in Solo, A Star Wars Story. Star Wars has gone strong for 50 years. It will go strong for another 50.
Okay, Caitlin, now you're Team B. Tell me why I should make a Marvel movie.
Well, Disney is a business, right? The main motivation is to make money. So the first thing Chapik would probably look at the historical financial successes of each franchise, just like Karen did. The Marvel Universe not only has the highest lifetime grossing movie in Avengers Endgame, it has 4 movies in the top 10 alone. And as another point, before determining whether to greenlight a movie or not, producers like to see that there's an existing fan base. That's why movies are often based on books, like Twilight or The Hunger Games, or are based on already existing storylines, like how Channing Tatum's movie 21 Jump Street was based on Johnny Depp's TV show of the same name. In this case, I would argue that the Marvel Universe currently has the largest existing fan base of all major movie franchises. Again, it's the highest ever grossing movie franchise, but the size and dedication of the fandom can be measured in other ways too. For example, we can look at the merchandise popularity and merchandise sales. By some estimates, Marvel merchandise has earned Disney around $41 billion, and part of the success lies in the sheer diversity of the merchandise that the company can offer. This is more than just t-shirts and action figures. In preparation for our episode today, I was looking at some of the Marvel items Disney was selling in its online store, and I saw everything from your average Marvel-branded t-shirts and then Funko Pops to even crazier items like a Spider-Man-themed inflatable T-Rex costume. Why you'd ever need one of those? I don't know. And if you're one for numbers, you can just look at the number of products offered for each franchise by Disney on its site. The company offers over 1,000 Marvel-branded items, but only about 836 Star Wars ones. We can also measure the fandom size and dedication by the amount of people that cosplay the franchise's characters at events like Comic-Cons. According to Zavi, Marvel is the third most popular franchise to cosplay in the world, behind My Hero Academia and the DC Comics. Star Wars, on the other hand, is sixth. The other thing that makes the Marvel Universe such a candidate for another film is the franchise's malleability and the interconnectivity between storylines. The structure of the Marvel Universe makes it so a literal infinite number of storylines can play out as films are released. There are parallel worlds and different dimensions, all where characters can exist and interact with other characters from the franchise that they may not have previously. This allows for more character-focused movies, like maybe the original Thor or The Incredible Hulk, where we see a character's origin and usually a single hero versus single villain plot. But it also allows for larger event-focused movies, like the 3 Avengers movies, which enable a multitude of characters to interact with each other. And this brings me to another point. All of these films are completely interconnected. Again, we see this through these large event-based movies and recurring themes, but we also see it in the after-credit clips that each movie has. These clips usually foreshadow future films or resolve another plot line. For example, in the post-credit scene in Iron Man, Nick Fury tells Stark that he is not the only superhero in the world and that they need to discuss the Avenger Initiative, which is foreshadowing the Avengers movie that would be released 4 years later. This primes viewers to anticipate future movies. The malleability of the universe also allows the Marvel franchise to stay relevant and appeal to a wide range of people. At times, Disney has stepped away from the typical superhero story and turned certain Marvel storylines into more genre films. For example, Ant-Man has a daring heist film style, while Captain America is a more political action movie, and Black Panther is Afrofuturism. And speaking of Black Panther, the malleability of Marvel storylines has allowed the franchise to be more progressive and culturally relevant than others. Whether you see it as Disney following the inclusivity trend to make money, or pointedly increasing diversity in Hollywood as a social statement, Black Panther became a social commentary that launched the film to being the current 14th top-grossing film of all time. And Disney has also done this with female superheroes like Captain Marvel and Black Widow. There's one final thing I wanted to mention because it plays into the intersection of pop culture and technology and specifically relates to how production companies make decisions. I read in my research for this episode that companies are starting to use artificial intelligence or AI to predict how movies might perform at the box office. This software uses historical data about movie performances and then pairs it with information about a prospective film's themes and actors. It then employs machine learning to find hidden patterns in the data humans may not recognize. The software even allows for a sort of plug and play with the cast. For example, you can see how using Margot Robbie over Emma Stone as the leading lady may affect a film's performance. And AI is being used in the movie industry in more ways than just that. Scriptbook claims to have algorithms that can predict a film's success by simply analyzing the script. Others claim to be able to predict viewer demographics and revenue by analyzing just a movie's trailer. It's just another really interesting and niche way that these two worlds, pop culture and tech, continually overlap.
Wow, difficult to compete with the MCU. Karen, do you have anything to counter to that Team B argument?
I do. Some of the issues that Caitlin brings up, for example, diversity or interconnectivity, we do see in the Star Wars universe. And I think actually Star Wars has done a very good job of integrating these ideas without really pushing it forward. It just becomes natural. So I think when we look at these two franchises, there's actually a lot of similarities between them. And this is one reason that as the CEO of Disney, you would really have to look at a by-the-numbers breakdown of the success of these movies. Again, Star Wars has a fraction of the number of movies that exist currently in the Marvel universe. And when you look at them over time, they were slightly cheaper to make. That's changed in the last decade. But if we were to look for a cheaper Star Wars movie, we could probably have a high rate of return that you might not find in the Marvel universe because so much money is being sunk into these Marvel movies, particularly the big tentpoles, the Avengers, things that bring together these huge casts that have a lot of money. One of the things that is interesting about the Star Wars franchise is a lot of the leads being used are relative unknowns. So whereas the Marvel Universe relies on A-list celebrities to drive viewership, Star Wars tends to take relative unknowns, Daisy Ridley, Adam Driver, and put them into these roles, thereby lowering the cost just a little bit, just a few million dollars.
Today's tech topic is cryptocurrency. Is it the future of finance and the key to Web 3.0, or is it a Ponzi scheme? Karen, what even is cryptocurrency?
Before we talk about cryptocurrency, we need to define what currency itself is. We think of currency as dollar bills and coins, but all currency really is a standardized medium of exchange or a store of value. The piece of paper or little circle of money on its own has all but no value. The value lies in what we agree that piece of paper represents. So we say that a US bill with a 10 on it represents $10, and we treat it as though it has that value. Now, fiat currency is backed by central governments. We might think of it as the national currency system, dollars, nickels, quarters, dimes, etc. Cryptocurrency, on the other hand, acts like currency in the sense that it is a store of value and a medium of exchange, but as a digital currency, there is no central bank that controls it. This means the value of each coin is set by the market. While it can be used as a currency and you can buy goods and services with some of the cryptocurrencies, the real reason that most people have heard of cryptocurrency right now is how it's being treated by investors. At present, cryptocurrencies act as a security or a commodity. Investors buy them because they believe they'll appreciate in value and they can sell them later for a profit. And historically, this has been very true. For example, as of 2021, Bitcoin was the best performing asset of the decade, returning 10 times more than the NASDAQ 100. The average stock market return over time is about 8%. But as of last year, Bitcoin's average annual return was 230%. Since 2011, Bitcoin's cumulative gains have exceeded 20 million%. Yes, you heard that right. 20 million%.
Okay, so it's internet money. Why would anyone use it in practice?
There are a variety of reasons people would use cryptocurrency. For example, say I wanted to send a friend in Australia some money. Right now, I'd have to either do a foreign wire transfer from my bank account to hers, which would cost me about $50, or I'd have to use a money order service like Western Union, which would also charge a fee. If I sent her the money as cryptocurrency, on the other hand, it might only cost me a few cents. And whereas the wire transfer would take a few days, by sending cryptocurrency, she would have the money in minutes. So speed and low transaction fees is one huge benefit. Another benefit is that in countries with unstable political or economic environments, it's a way to keep money safe, at least theoretically. Funds in a bank account can be seized, or if the bank fails, be lost, but cryptocurrency held in a wallet can only be accessed by the wallet's owner. And because cryptocurrency prices are set by a global market, cryptocurrency owners can ride out domestic fluctuations of fiat currency. This means that the local dollar could fall by 25%, but cryptocurrency won't be affected. The final reason people might own and use cryptocurrency is the combination of anonymity and secure transactions. Blockchain technology uses decentralized ledgers to record all transactions on the blockchain. This means that if I send my Australian friend money, anyone can see that the transaction occurred. She can't claim I never sent the money. But while people can see the transaction, they don't know who we are. They just see the money moving from one wallet to another. While most of us probably don't even think about whether we want or need privacy in our financial transactions, to some people, it's very important. They don't want a bank or national government seeing what they do with their money or to whom they send it.
Okay, so let's say Team A is that cryptocurrency is the greatest thing since sliced bread. It's the future of finance and maybe even the internet. What evidence do we have to support this?
This is going to be a little complicated, so I'm going to try and simplify it as much as possible. Let's start with the idea of smart contracts. One of the things that the blockchain can do is act as a contract without needing the intervention of a lawyer. So let's say that I want to set up a trust for my niece so that when she's 21, she can access a certain amount of money. Under the usual system, I have to hire a lawyer to create a trust that will then hold the funds and then release them on her birthday. Using cryptocurrency, however, all I have to do is create a cryptocurrency wallet for her and then program a smart contract so that on the correct date, the money will move from my wallet to hers. No lawyer is necessary, and once the contract is programmed, it can't be undone. While this is a small-scale example, smart contracts can have broad applications for a variety of different areas, such as real estate, supply chain management, and finance. Smart contracts reduce cost while ensuring compliance by both parties. This is good for business. I mentioned just now that governments can't seize cryptocurrency the way they can fiat currency. This isn't a risk for most people, but it can happen. In 2013, for example, the Central Bank of Cyprus seized uninsured deposits in citizen bank accounts holding more than $100,000 to help recapitalize itself. But before it settled on that option, it even looked into taking a percentage of deposits below that amount. That means the government was literally going to steal money from all of its citizens that had bank accounts. Anyone holding cryptocurrency, however, would have been immune from that seizure. This also holds true for bank freezes, as has occurred recently in Lebanon. While we trust that our money in banks is safe, that's not always the case around the world. Cryptocurrency opens up the possibility of financial access to parts of the world where access is currently lacking. Right now, there are approximately 2.2 billion people who have access to the internet but do not have access to traditional exchange systems, either because they can't get bank accounts or for another reason. Cryptocurrency gives these people the ability to send and receive money near instantaneously at a tiny cost. A good case study for this is Kenya. Right now, 1 in 3 Kenyans have a Bitcoin wallet, while over 90% of Kenyans have the mobile phone-based money transfer app M-Pesa. This shows there's a huge market for this kind of microfinance system. Cryptocurrency also reduces banking and consumer fraud. Let's say I buy something from a website that's later hacked. The cyber criminals could get access to my credit card information and use it to buy things online. But if I paid using cryptocurrency, all they'll have is my wallet address, which is useless to them. And businesses don't have to worry that they're being handed a counterfeit bill that will be useless to them. By using cryptocurrency, both buyers and sellers are protected. Finally, as the world moves more and more towards small online payments, cryptocurrency reduces what we may think of as friction in those financial transactions. Much of our current infrastructure is set up for larger transactions. This means that the transaction facilitator, like Visa or MasterCard, gets a cut of the profit to enable the trade. But what if you're paying a toll or buying something that is in a video game? Such a small transaction, and many of these small transactions, put a load on Visa's system without Visa getting much to show for it. Cryptocurrency is well set up for these micropayments, greasing the wheel of this background economy.
Okay, so what's this Web 3.0 I'm hearing about, and how is cryptocurrency involved?
The internet has evolved over time. Web 1.0 was the first iteration of the internet, which lasted until about the year 2000. At this time, websites were very simple. People were just learning about the capabilities of the internet and how to post content, with most people viewing the content rather than creating it. Web 2.0, which is what we're currently living, is much more interactive and capable. The internet has more bandwidth and servers, allowing real-time communication between users around the world. Users are content creators, active on social media, blogs, and sharing sites. At the same time, the Web 2.0 business model takes user data and sells it to third parties for marketing, meaning everyone is competing to build an audience, collect data, and sell it. Web 3.0, which is still on the horizon, is expected to integrate even more of our lives online while allowing users more control over their online experience. At least theoretically, decentralization and blockchain ledgers will allow individuals to maintain their own data and privacy, allowing them to opt into ads in return for micropayments or opt out completely. We may also see the metaverse, a digital virtual 3D world in which users can collaborate, shop, and socialize. Put another way, if Web 2.0 opened the world up to greater communication but turned users into a commodity, Web 3.0 aims to continue that expansion while at the same time returning sovereignty to users.
Okay. So Laura, what's Team B's position? Why should we be wary about cryptocurrency?
Well, let's start with the fact that technically, the world doesn't need a decentralized digital payment system. At an individual level, we can send money to each other already for free using PayPal, Venmo, Zelle, Cash App, etc. So that example that Karen gave of sending money to Australia using an international wire transfer, that's very old school. The world has moved past that. Moreover, fiat currencies could be put on the blockchain. The US central bank could actually create a US digital coin that would have all the properties of a cryptocurrency, but be centrally managed and run as a fiat currency. This would give it many of the advantages of a cryptocurrency while still having the benefits of government backing. This is already happening in China and could happen elsewhere in the world as well. As to putting your money into cryptocurrency to ride out domestic political or economic fluctuations, that's a very, very dangerous move. Right now, cryptocurrency markets are highly volatile. The value of the coin can change by 1, 10, or even 100% in a single day. And since the market operates in a bull bear cycle, the value of a coin from the peak to the trough can drop 90% or more. That kind of volatility doesn't exist among fiat currencies. Why would anyone put their money in a currency that might be worth 10% less tomorrow than it is today if they're worried about their domestic financial situation? Another concern we should have about cryptocurrency is what we might call the Beanie Baby problem. Bear with me. Back in 1998, Beanie Babies, which were these small animal toys made by the company Tai, were briefly hailed as a safer investment than stocks. Investors snatched them up by the dozen, certain that over time, the value of rare toys would go up by thousands of dollars. But these dreams of profit ended up shattered. Beanie Babies didn't become valuable collector's items. Instead, with Tai issuing a large supply, demand petered out. People lost their shirts for literal children's toys. And today, it's easy to buy Beanie Babies in thrift shops for mere pennies. What happened? The premise that Beanie Babies would have value relied on a speculative bubble. The idea that in the future, these toys would be worth a lot more than they were at the time of purchase. For years, many people have argued that cryptocurrency is a speculative bubble. For example, popular economist and columnist Paul Krugman famously wrote in the New York Times in 2018 that Bitcoin was, quote, a bubble wrapped in techno-mysticism inside a cocoon of libertarian ideology, end quote. In fact, 8 Nobel Prize winners in economics, including Krugman, have called cryptocurrency a speculative bubble, as have investors Warren Buffett and George Soros, big names in financial markets. And in June this year, Bill Gates even said that cryptocurrencies were 100% based on greater fool theory. If these famous people are right, this is a $1 trillion bubble just waiting to burst. Much of the problem here is that cryptocurrency has no intrinsic value. Fiat currencies, by comparison, are backed by central banks. The bank guarantees the value of the currency. Once upon a time, these fiat currencies were even tied to other items of value, like gold. As a result, the global monetary system is stable and tied to financial markets and assets. But what is cryptocurrency? You can't see it. You can't hold it in your hand. And most people probably don't even understand what it represents on the blockchain or even what a blockchain is. Time and again, over the past few years, a cryptocurrency has completely lost its value and investors are left with nothing to show for it. Like Beanie Babies, cryptocurrencies only have value if people believe they have value. With nothing to back them up and limited quality to backstop it, cryptocurrencies could easily collapse. And what about Ponzi schemes? The crypto space is extremely prone to fraud. In 2018, for example, the cryptocurrency lending platform BitConnect was shut down. And in 2021, the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission accused it of being a Ponzi scheme that defrauded investors of $3.5 billion. And it's just one of many examples. OneCoin, for example, defrauded investors of $5.8 billion through a multi-level marketing scheme. Even when a cryptocurrency isn't an intentional Ponzi scheme, many coins benefit from investors' lack of understanding about cryptocurrency. For example, Dogecoin, which has been hyped by Elon Musk, was created as a joke about wild cryptocurrency speculation. At one time, was worth 73 cents per coin and had a market cap of over $1 billion. In essence, it's a $1 billion joke. There are also environmental costs to cryptocurrency as well that challenge its long-term growth potential and popularity. Cryptocurrency is mined. This means that people called miners use advanced computers to validate blockchain transactions and ensure the integrity and accuracy of blockchain ledgers. The problem is these computers take up a huge amount of energy. Last year, for example, Bitcoin mining made up 0.5% of the world's electricity consumption, with carbon dioxide emissions roughly on par with Sri Lanka or Jordan. In 2022, cryptocurrency used as much power as Argentina. This means that absent changes to the cryptocurrency ecosystem that makes it more energy efficient, cryptocurrency is very bad for the environment. Why spend energy resources making a digital currency when we can print bills using renewable resources? Cryptocurrency enthusiasts have hailed blockchain's ability to privatize transactions, but that's not necessarily a good thing. Criminals have used cryptocurrency to launder money or buy materials like guns and drugs on the dark web. Cryptocurrency makes it much harder for law enforcement to track these illegal activities. Should we really be supporting a currency that makes it easier for criminals to do bad things?
Okay. Well, Laura, do you have anything to counter Karen or Team A's position?
Team A makes a lot of interesting claims, many of which rely on future situations and wide-scale adoption. It's sometimes difficult to argue against the unknowable. Will crypto and Web3 pioneers be looked back on as the Silicon Valley technology disruptors that fundamentally changed consumers' relationship with the internet? Or will this be another Beanie Baby scenario? Hindsight will definitely be 2020. We have to be careful to separate exuberant optimism expressed by crypto enthusiasts from the facts. The proponents of Web3 and cryptocurrency evangelize loudly on social media and other forums, and that can sometimes drown out negative news. For example, each year we hear about failed crypto ventures by CEOs who genuinely believed in the success of their coin, but then saw it fail. For example, this year, a so-called stablecoin, Terra USD, crashed, causing investors to lose $40 billion. That's real money. Although most stablecoins are backed by real-world commodities like the dollar, Terra wasn't. And the consequences of Terra and its associated coin Luna failing were catastrophic. So much for the argument that the crypto industry is a good safe haven for money. Sometimes investors lose everything instead. For now, crypto is too speculative to be used for some of the things crypto enthusiasts have offered, like micropayments in the developing world. And one could argue that, like Elizabeth Holmes' fake it till you make it startup approach towards consumers' health, a similar attitude towards cryptocurrency and Web3 is naive and irresponsible. It will be hard for cryptocurrency to be more widely adopted when it still has such massive fraud and volatility in the ecosystem. Another thing to note is that although most cryptocurrencies are decentralized and proudly declare that they can't be controlled by national governments, holders of those currencies still may be. In the United States, for example, cryptocurrency is taxed the same way a stock, security, or commodity is. And in cases where criminal activity is suspected, the government can compel U.S. exchanges like Coinbase or Kraken to provide information about account holders. Governments can also choose to regulate what coins can be legally traded within their borders. Just because federal governments to date have loosely regulated the crypto space does not mean that they won't do that in a few years. Finally, while Web3 has been hailed as a decentralized answer to Web 2.0, which we all know is dominated by big tech firms, some think it's only a matter of time before big tech or government regulation take hold of what some describe as the socio-political movement that is Web3. Put pessimistically, there's no way the likes of Facebook and Google will let go of that cash cow that is user data, not to mention the land grab for the metaverse. Web3 supporters may be idealists, but the world is realist, and Web3 likely won't be as egalitarian and autonomous as they hope.
Team A, anything to counter Team B's position?
Team B makes a lot of good points, some of which are pretty irrefutable. But something that isn't captured is the value of cryptocurrencies that exceeds just a currency function. The smart contract feature in many cryptocurrencies makes them, in essence, programmable money. It's hard to come up with a fair market valuation for major cryptocurrencies like Ethereum because we don't know how important those smart contracts will be or how much the micropayments function will be used in the future once cryptocurrencies are more commonly used. So while most cryptocurrencies could definitely be in a bubble, riding the coattails of the big cryptocurrencies, some might currently be undervalued. For example, since 2019, Bitcoin has conducted a higher volume of transactions than PayPal. Regarding the legitimacy of cryptocurrencies, 61 of the world's top 100 banks invest in blockchain and cryptocurrency. Some banks are even incorporating blockchain into their banking portfolios. Added to that, 16% of Americans report they've used or invested in a cryptocurrency. While many people may think of cryptocurrency as something that's hidden in the shadows or on the horizon, the truth is it's already here and it's in the open. The structured analytic technique that we'll be looking at in the next episode is called devil's advocacy. I don't want to give too much away, but we'll definitely be discussing the mysterious death of billionaire Jeffrey Epstein. Find out what Gossipint thinks of it all on our next episode.